I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world. From the heart of the Middle East, the Trump administration is attempting to rewrite Washington's relationship with Moscow after years of the US funding proxy wars, weaponizing sanctions, and ensuring Western European states remain vassal states hostile to Russia, China, and Iran. For Donald Trump and members of his administration, the constant mantra is that policy is guided by common sense. But are the economic and geostrategic axioms underpinning the policies of elites all around the world actually anything to do with common sense? Why do sanctions and tariffs benefit the targets of sanctions and tariffs? Why does so-called democracy benefit oligarchs? Is there something fundamentally mistaken about our ideas of supply and demand that is destroying the world? A new book, Entropy Economics, The Living Basis of Value and Production, aims to revolutionize global thinking about how our world actually works and why this should inform our perspectives on wars from Ukraine to Gaza to China and Iran to the elite war on the poor in rich countries. One of its co-authors is Professor James Galbraith of the University of Texas. He used to work for the U.S. Congress and has edited the works of his father, FDR, JFK and Johnson advisor, John Kenneth Galbraith. He joins me from Austin, Texas. Professor Galbraith, thank you so much for coming on. Before we get to how your book with Jing Chen explains how Russia benefited from NATO nation sanctions, something that is not really written about in NATO countries, can I just ask how societies that do not limit monopoly power, they destroy themselves? That's one of the issues that you explain in the book. But actually, come to think of it, what is entropy economics at all, the title of this book?
Well, the basic thesis of the book is that our conventional view of economic life, which comes down to us from 18th century from Adam Smith and was reinforced in the 20th century by the mathematization of the discipline, is rooted in the idea that the ideal system is a self-organizing competitive economy, and that the forces of the market, supply and demand, will give you a good outcome, an optimal outcome in the jargon. This is not the way science took a very different turn long ago in the 19th century. The ideas of evolution, the idea of thermodynamics, the introduction of the entropy law into general understanding in biology and physics underpins everything that we understand about the natural world, the mechanical world. But out here in economics, it has never penetrated people's understanding. And so they, although businesses get it because they have to operate in the real world, economists and policymakers frequently don't. And they generally design policies on the basis of a model, a paradigm, if you like, which doesn't serve their purposes.
So the normal way we think about things is supply.
The effect of the sanctions on the Russian Federation over the last 11 years, but especially the last 3 years.
Yeah, I'll get on to that, but just how we basically understand economics is supply and demand, then it reaches some sort of equilibrium. And time again in this book, you show that whilst that whole idea is actually not how the world works, equilibrium is actually death.
Well, it's really a fiction, I would say, that. And in the real world, life processes depend upon tapping in to what one can describe as low entropy resources. That is to say, into sources of economic value. And that is underpinning that, of course, is energy. And classical economists in the 19th century understood this, and they understood energy to be labor. Jevons understood that coal was important. Well, we ought to understand now, there are a panoply of resources that are available to us, whether they are abundant or expensive, matters a great deal to the ability to do anything else. And so, for example, if you look at the American New Deal, and you say, okay, why did it succeed in transforming America into the top-level industrial economy that it became in the 20th century? And part of the answer to that is clearly the sudden availability in the 1930s of vast amounts of inexpensive oil that was discovered in Texas beginning in 1930. And part of it is the application of hydropower to the electrification of the country, Tennessee Valley Authority, Bonneville Power Authority, and many others throughout the country. So that the basis for the industrial and economic success of the United States in the post-war period was laid in this period by building up a new energy-based infrastructure. That's what we mean by tapping into low entropy. And of course, what that tells you is that if you pursue a policy which raises energy costs in one area, let's call it Europe under the sanctions, while keeping them stable or even reducing them in another, then you're going to see a differential in the economic effects. And that's very clear. It's also clear that in the U.S. in the age of fracking, that the U.S. has had an advantage over Europe for the same reason.
Yeah, since we keep going to the sanctions, people who say why, try to explain why Russia seems to have economically benefited since 2022 are saying it's because of sanctions busting and that's why Russia is doing well. Just explain how your economics theory shows one explanation of why Russia's actually done so well out of European and United States policy.
Sure. We offer a very simple theory of value in which the economic value of any kind of new project depends basically on two factors. One of them is scarcity, very familiar, scarcity, and the other one is market power, monopoly power. And so what we're arguing is that if you have a large market that you can build into, that's very good for potential profitability. And if you have fewer competitors, again, very good for potential profitability. And that is a dynamic process, which as you build out and saturate the market, the economic value of what you're doing is going to go down. So what happened with sanctions? The idea behind the sanctions on the part of their authors, which they laid out very clearly, was that you're going to deprive the Russian Federation of capital, advanced capital supplied by the Western corporations that were operating there. You were going to deprive them of labor by encouraging immigration of technical people. You were going to deprive them of finances by cutting them off from Western banking systems. What in fact happened was that you, by removing the competition that Western firms were already present and providing in the Russian economy, from fast food restaurants, big box stores, automobile companies, you name it, the sanctions created market space within which Russian companies could grow and prosper. And of course, the fact that Russia has become substantially a business economy, operating under the same principles of any other business economy, it's no longer a centrally planned Soviet-style economy, meant that they could, in fact, just applying ordinary business principles, take advantage of this improvement in the climate. That's a very simple story, actually. What is astonishing, though, is that you don't arrive at that conclusion if you apply the principles of mainstream conventional economics. That people say, well, the sanctions didn't work, the Russians evaded them, and so on and so forth. And that is contradicted by the Russian analysts themselves, who write very frankly that the sanctions had a crisis impact when they were first implemented in 2022. And so the problem here is not that the sanctions didn't have an effect, but that in fact they did have the very substantial effects exactly as they were designed to. But the designers didn't take account of the real world conditions that they were creating and the capacity of Russian businesses to accommodate themselves and adjust, which after a short period they were able to do.
And is this because European policymakers, the people in the Biden administration, were idiots, or is it because of fundamental problems in their understanding of the way economics works? I mean, I'll return to that, because time and time again in your book you show about theories of knowledge and I'll go on to that, but I mean, what is the reason? Were they just idiotic? Because that doesn't even involve entropy and economics. What you just said, that explanation necessarily.
Well, it does actually. But I'm disinclined to regard people as idiots.
Sure.
But I do think they were pursuing a vision, which has been the predominant one in American economics since the 1950s. And it was developed for particular ideological purposes also associated with the Cold War, to give, let's say, advanced capitalism a model of development that would look attractive and compete ideologically and maybe also practically with the Soviet Union at that time. And that was what neoclassical growth economics was all about. And it was about smoothing out the elements of conflict and overlooking the enormous command of over cheap resources that the United States and its allies enjoyed in that period. So when you put those two things together, you get a model which was periodically challenged, and the challenges were always brushed off, but which basically controlled the mentality of American economists of my generation. I went to graduate school in the 1970s, and it was exceedingly clear that this was the vision, and it was already falling out of date at that time, and it certainly should have been abandoned long ago, but it never has been. And now, fundamentally, academic economics departments are incapable of adjusting, making the changes in their worldview, because everybody's committed to the previous one, and they filter out anybody who has a tendency to dissent. So it's a structural problem, a structural intellectual ideological problem, and which is I think trapping our economy into a and affecting it right now. The policies of the Trump administration are very much in the same, affected by the same, let's say, intellectual malady, intellectual narrow-mindedness. So it's not just relating to the Biden administration. It's a very common problem.
Yeah, I'll get on to the tariffs, which I think you're referring to there. But when you were talking about how FDR's New Deal relied on these new energy resources to make what became the greatest economy in world history, related to what you were just saying about structural class formations, I suppose, you quote from Orwell about the need to separate ourselves from those at the coal pit, and presumably right now what we're wearing from the oil workers that produce fibres and the cotton picking and so on. Just explain why that's so important a component to equilibrium, supply and demand, neoclassical economic theory.
Yeah, we quote, I guess it's the Road to Wigan Pier, and Orwell's great tribute to the coal miners who underpin everything. And in another little snippet in the book, we talk about the situation in North America and in the Yukon or northern British Columbia, where there were towns that were substantial, prosperous towns a century and a half ago, rooted around gold mining. If you went up there and conducted an economic survey, you'd find that only a tiny fraction of their economic activity measure, as we now measure it, was actually related, mining itself. They had saloons and they had hotels and they had cabarets and they had, of course, food stores and everything else. And you add all that up and say, well, mining was only maybe 5% of what was going on here.
Professor Galbraith, we're going to have to return in part two. Right now, hang on a second.
The towns disappeared and they became ghost towns.
Professor Galbraith,
over the American West.
Professor Galbraith, I'll just have to stop you there for end of part one. Yep. I'll just stop you there. More from the University of Texas at Austin professor and co-author of Entropy Economics, The Living Basis of Value and Production, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the University of Texas at Austin professor and co-author of Entropy Economics, The Living Basis of Value and Production, Professor James Galbraith. Professor Galbraith, I rudely interrupted in part one. You were in the middle of talking about the Yukon, I think, as an example of how the original resource that one's after is just a tiny part of the full story.
Sure. And if you, as I say, you do the accounting the way we now do it, those resources looked like they were very small, but they were abundant. And when they ran out, everything else fell apart. So that just tells you that the resource base of the economy is, it's not the only thing, but it is a crucial element toward let's say, building up a successful position.
And so you were talking about Trump, who clearly thinks that tariffs are a great way of rejuvenating the US economy and helping the deficit problems that the United States have. In your book, Entropy Economics analyzes tariffs and comes out with a different conclusion.
Yeah, we do, and let me just address the where I think the Trump vision is short of what would be required over the long run, if it were possible to rejuvenate the American economy. Basically, it was it consists the vision consists of putting up tariff walls, which may or may not, in fact, go up, although some of them are already in place, with the idea that at that point, private businesses, major corporations will expand their operations in the United States. But that overlooks the fact that if you leave it entirely to private corporations, they have an alternative strategy, which is simply to restrict output and raise prices. And that's a very profitable strategy from their point of view, but one which leaves the American consumer and the firms that use the product, steel and aluminum and so forth, in a position of having much higher costs and lower profitability. So it's not at all obvious that it works. I'll come back to the situation in the early 1940s in the United States, when the government needed private business to radically expand the capacity to produce armaments, to produce rubber, to produce clothing, for that matter, and to produce ammunition, deployed a whole range of tools, including building the factories itself in order to get that capacity. Private business didn't want to do it. They didn't know how long the war was going to last. They didn't know how much what they could do without capacity once it was over. They had to be essentially directed and led by the nose. And we still have laws, the Defense Production Act, that could make that possible. But the Trump vision is just put up the tariff walls and the markets will do it for you. And there again, they're falling into the trap of allowing people with this 18th century mentality, or people who basically do know, only pretend to have that mentality, but are essentially acting as predatory monopolists to control what will actually happen behind the tariff wall. And that is a serious, that's going to be a serious problem toward the implementation. If you concede the vision has some merit to it, it's a serious problem for its implementation.
So there's a deep ideological reason to propagandize for the idea of supply and demand and so forth, because the people who formulate it knew that monopolies were going to be the consequence of this kind of economic model. I mean, we obviously have oligarchs now, and they're obvious how a few big high-tech companies rule our lives and so on. So there was a reason to stop other economic models from coming to the fore.
Yes, of course. And the hyper-libertarianism of the oligarchs reflects their own ideology. But it's an interesting situation, actually, in that a group of tech oligarchs, of tech tycoons, who were a few years ago, a few weeks ago, free traders, have suddenly come into the Trump tent and align themselves with the tariff policy. And why is that? I think partly because they want to stay in the government's good graces for purposes of contracting, and partly because they feel that the technology that they operate is no longer the world's cutting edge. And of course, the arrival of DeepSeek a few weeks ago gave them a pretty shocking lesson into what can happen to their capital valuations when a superior competitor suddenly appears on the scene. And so they would like to have the trade protections. And this gives you some sense of what their objectives may really be.
I mean, they would deny
Let me make
that.
A
They would
broader
deny
point,
that and
which
profess
is
to
about Yeah, good.
They tend to say it's all Ayn Rand and kind of pseudo-Hayek economics. I mean, it's that that informs this kind of oligarch class.
It is, of course, and what I think the real world will tell you that there is no sophisticated market that exists without capable regulation. Not every regulation is worth preserving. Not everyone is a good idea. But it is regulation that gives you the possibility to have long supply chains and sophisticated production processes, because it's regulation that assures you the quality of what you're dealing with. Otherwise, the costs of transacting in that and the risks become unbearable. I would argue, in fact, that regulation, good regulation, is the key to economic development.
Yeah, you're very.
And this has been realized by those countries that have developed successfully. Yeah,
but the worst crisis of recent years has been 2008, and you explore that it's not. In the book, you expand on the fact that it's not too little regulation that caused the crash in 2008, which is the widespread myth that's propagated. It was too much predatory regulation.
Well, it was the financial sector had been deregulated systematically since the end of the 1970s, culminating with the repeal of Glass-Steagall in the late 1990s, and the abolition of the government's monitoring function in the early 2000s. And this facilitated an enormous amount of financial fraud. An enormous amount of financial fraud, which looked very good on the books up until 2006, 2007, when everybody began to realize that the paper they were holding in their own portfolios wasn't worth anything, and then the financial system melted down. So you have, this is exactly the analogy of a nuclear reactor that runs too hot, that runs without a cooling system. The metaphor is the same. You get a meltdown sooner or later.
Yeah, but it's regulated to run hot, arguably. Anyway, well, I know we're running out of time here, and there's so many mathematical equations in here co-author Jing Chen. I don't want to frighten people off from reading it. Jing Chen models some of the entropy economics in a variety of different fields. Perhaps most dangerous is the one regarding democracies that you talk about, how and why it is that so-called democracies in, I don't know, NATO countries, in two-party systems, they always benefit oligarchs and not the masses. Just take us as briefly as you can through that.
It's easy to...
You quoted Churchill. Model,
yeah, sure. It's easy to model divide and conquer in this way. But you can see that it's to the advantage of the top dogs, as we describe them, to keep the bottom dogs basically competing with each other for the scraps of resources that they are permitted to have. And the right strategy for the larger community is one of cohesion. That's a very simple simple application of the mathematics.
Well, people have to read it to explain, to see how democracy will always tend towards helping the oligarchs. Just very finally, then, very quickly, you explain the distribution of nuclear weapons among different countries, again, using the model. I'm just trying to pick a few different cases.
Yeah, a nice example of the modeling is that you have a small number of nuclear weapons countries which have permitted them to each other and deny them to the rest of the world. I'm not necessarily objecting to that. But what we point out is that other weapons, so-called weapons of mass destruction, are banned altogether. Why? Because they're widely accessible to other actors, and they were much more easily obtained. And so you get a good sense of how we'll call it opportunity hoarding or the hoarding of power plays out in the modern world.
And that's why those countries get to have them, and others don't. So when we hear Donald Trump talk about common sense, the phrase common sense, that's actually a kind of code for hiding behind the neoclassical economics that you're in your book saying is actually not the way the world works?
Well, I'm not entirely sure where Trump and his, that you can define this administration in any single consistent way. Trump himself appears to have an old-fashioned nationalist view, going back to William McKinley, of supporting national industrial development. And then he's empowered all these people who are free market libertarians within that perspective, hoping that they'll carry out the work for him. And that's not how it happened in the United States. It wasn't William McKinley. It was Theodore Roosevelt and then Franklin Roosevelt under very different structures of management control.
Maybe it's Marxist dialectic, having both of them there.
Well, there's, of course, Marx was in the age of Darwin, and the dialectics are a real thing, sure.
Ultimately, in your books, it suggests that only some kind of revolution arguably can change the current status quo, because you're predicting, using these models, shorter lifespans, harsher inequalities, smaller populations.
Well, I think that points certainly in that direction. And one way to apply the basic ideas here is to ask, how does the modern household make economic decisions? And what one finds is that in an advanced society, the household has lots of fixed commitments. It has mortgages, it has utility bills, it has tuition payments, it has savings for retirement, all these things, which then, when you put them under resource constraints, you put them under austerity policies, they look for ways to try and make ends meet. And of course, from the standpoint of the individual household, one of the most expensive things they can do is have more children. So perfectly rationally and perfectly in a perfectly self-protective way, families decide that they will have fewer children or no children, that they will have more income earners relative to the number of children that they have. Both parents will work, maybe multiple adults in a household will work. And this makes it very difficult to meet for any rich society to meet the replacement rate on individual fertility. And in fact, I don't think there are any rich societies now who meet that target.
Professor Galbraith, we're out of time. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed very much having a chance to talk to you.
And that's it for the final show this season. Entropy Economics, The Living Basis of Value and Production is out now. We'll be back with a brand new season on Saturday, the 3rd of May. Until then, we'll be airing your favourite episodes of this season every Saturday and Monday. Remember, you can still keep in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored in your country, then head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you very soon.